There you go. Call to Administrative Rules Committee to order. John, do you want to take the roll?
Representative Devlin.
Here.
Representative Banning.
Here.
Representative Bashy.
Here.
Representative Fatsford.
Here.
Representative Heller.
Here.
Representative V. Koppelman.
Here.
Representative K. Koppelman. Representative Owens. Representative Schatz.
Here.
Representative Silbernagle.
Here.
Representative Thorson. Representative Tolman.
Here.
Representative Weiss. Senator Armstrong.
Present.
Senator Andrist. Senator Heckerman.
Here.
Senator Klein.
Here.
Senator Triplett.
I'm here.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, John. Consideration of the minutes for the June 11th meeting. What's the committee's wishes?
Move to approve.
Move by Senator Armstrong, second. Second by Senator Klein. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. John, do you want to explain why Burnett's here? She just didn't want to just visit, so I assume there's more going on here that we need to explain.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's always been one of Vonette's ambitions to...
I'll bet it has.
...sit in the Administrative Rules Committee meeting with me.
My life is complete.
Well, in reality, we've had a retirement in our office. Jay Burringard, after 42 years of service, finally retired. We've had some changes. I'm now the new Jay. Vonette will be the new me. And she will henceforth be staff for the Administrative Rules Committee. That doesn't mean I won't show up for meetings, because I like hanging out with you. So I should be around, but Vonette will be the new admin code publisher and will be reviewing the rules as they're submitted and so on, and getting things ready for the committee's work. So I hope you will treat her with the kindness that you've always treated me, because, well, frankly, she deserves it more than I do.
Well, welcome, Burnett, and John, thank you, of course, for everything you've done for us. We'll move into the 8:30 agenda item, presentation from the Representative State Board of Registration for Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors.
Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Nelson. I'm a registered professional engineer and professional land surveyor in North Dakota. I'm also chairman of the North Dakota State Board of Registration for Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors. The North Dakota Board of Registration for Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors, the board, is making changes to the North Dakota Administrative Code because of significant changes to exam administration procedures on the national level. Additional changes are being made to keep the rules consistent with modern technology and business practices. These rules are not a result of any statutory change. These rules are not related to any federal statute or regulation. The board followed the procedures to promulgate rules as required by North Dakota Century Code 28-32. The board drafted rules changes. Our special assistant to the Attorney General, Lyle Kermis, prepared a long and short notice of rulemaking, published a hearing notice in every official county newspaper via the North Dakota Newspaper Association, and conducted a hearing. The board inadvertently did not mail the proposed rule changes to the Legislative Council. Our SAAG and the Attorney General's office concluded that filing the notice with the Legislative Council, then waiting 20 days, and then conducting another hearing would be substantial compliance with rulemaking procedures, and that's the process that we did follow. After another comment period, the board adopted the rules changes. During the hearing, In comment periods, there were no oral or written concerns, objections, or complaints regarding the proposed rules. The only comment received was a letter from a representative of the North Dakota Society of Professional Engineers. The letter was in support of the rules changes. I'll briefly go through the revisions that we have. Found on page 11 of the packet is 28-02.1-0201, paragraphs 2 and 4, processing of applications. The changes being made to this section are the result of substantial changes to the exam administration process at the national level. Two of the national exams, the fundamentals of engineering and the fundamentals of surveying, are now being administered by a computer rather than the traditional paper and pencil exams. Previously, the FE and FS exams were available only 2 days of the year. Now the exam is available for the first 2 months of every calendar quarter. Because of the large number of testing windows, the national movement is to allow individuals to take the fundamentals examinations when they feel they are prepared, rather than wait for board approval. Individuals can now take the exam at a time of their choosing and apply to the board for enrollment as an intern after they have passed the exam. These changes in subsections 2 and 4 clarify that exam approval is required for principals and practice exams only. B, found on page 12, is 28-02.10401, paragraph 4, general requirements. The language here is being removed because it is no longer relevant or necessary. Found on page 13 is 28-02.10602, qualifications and requirements, professional land surveyor by examination. In the past, the only acceptable experience for a professional land surveyor was experience that was gained after the individual graduated from school. However, there is no minimum education requirement for registration as a professional land surveyor, so many applicants have no formal education at all, therefore no graduation date. Also, many individuals are returning to school for formal education later in life after many years of working. This change will allow the board to consider all of the work experience rather than just the experience gained after graduation. D, beginning on page 14, is 28-02.108, paragraphs 2 and 4, seals. The changes being made in this section are the result of changing business practices. The emphasis on going green or going paperless has created a demand by the profession that engineering and land surveying documents be electronically created, transmitted, and stored. The language changes here allow for electronic seals and electronic signatures. The final subsection defines the term signature and includes language for a digital or electronic signature. E, found on pages 16 and 17, is 28-02.10803, use of seals. The changes in this section remove the requirement that signatures must be original. The term signature is left because the proposed definition encompasses both ink and digital signatures. The final change in this section allows for electronic storage of documents. The previous language required that paper copies of drawings, plans, survey plots, etc. be kept in a known location. These changes allow for scanning and archiving of older documents as well as maintaining more recent electronic documents. 6. The approximate cost of the rulemaking process was $2,700. 7. No economic impact statement was required by North Dakota Century Code Section 28-3208.1, paragraph 5. Per NDCC Section 28-3208, no regulatory analysis was prepared because an analysis has not been requested and the rules do not have an impact on the regulated community in excess of $50,000. 8. In compliance with North Dakota Century Code Section 28-3208.2, no fiscal note was prepared because there is no anticipated fiscal impact on any revenues or expenditures as a result of any of the rules changes. 9. No constitutional takings assessment was prepared because no rule limits the use of private real property. And finally, 10, these rules are not being adopted as a result of an emergency. Conclusion. These proposed rules changes address the changing exam environment and give individuals greater access to the exams and allow the exams to be taken at a time of the individual's choosing. Additionally, these rules address the changing business environment and allow for eliminating the cumbersome requirement of retaining original paper copies of engineering and land surveying work product, should a company choose to do so. That concludes my presentation. I would entertain any questions you might have.
Questions on the committee? Mr. Nelson? Senator Triplett?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if this is a question for Mr. Nelson or maybe for staff, but are we working to be consistent in changes across the administrative code as we're moving toward digitization? I mean, is the language in this subset of the administrative code similar to digital and digital language and security of signatures and such in other sections?
That probably is for me, because I'm probably the only one in the whole world who's read the entire code. Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, this would be consistent with changes that are being made. It's happening sort of gradually, a little piece at a time, but this would comply with the growth and development in that area statutorily and in rules. This is actually kind of on the cutting edge of rules.
I guess I wasn't so concerned that it would comply with statute. I trust that that would always happen, but rather that as different groups make these changes, that the part of the rules that define it are consistent across the code, the administrative code. Does that, am I making sense? Just in terms of the language, so that, you know, that an attorney in the future reading one section and another section, and that there's a slight language variation, doesn't go, well, this must mean something, when in fact it really doesn't, because we just weren't paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting my drift?
I am. Okay. And this is one of the first agencies that has made these kinds of changes. But there are statutory provisions, and these look very similar to the statutory, so I don't see a potential language conflict arising from these.
Further questions? Representative Sobernagle.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson, I should have probably done this before the session, but could you just briefly give us what is the description of a professional engineer, a definition, if you will?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Sobernagle and committee members, generally a definition of a professional engineer is an individual who is licensed in the state of North Dakota, who practices in the profession of engineering, which requires special skill, knowledge, and abilities in math and sciences and technology.
If I may, specifically civil engineering, architectural engineering, not industrial engineering or those types of engineering.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silvernagle, that is correct. There are some industrial exemptions. The definition itself of professional engineering is not restrictive to the type of practice of engineering, but there are exemptions for people that work in industry. If the individual works for an employer that produces products solely for itself and not to the general public, then they are exempt, so they don't have to be licensed.
Further questions, Mr. Nelson? Seeing none, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Moving on to the representative from the Ag Commissioner regarding their rules, which appear on page 1-8 of your booklet.
Thank you. morning, Chairman Devlin and members of the Administrative Rules Committee. I'm Eric Delzer. I'm the Fertilizer Program Specialist with the North Dakota Department of Agriculture. I'm here today to discuss the proposed changes in Title VII of the Administrative Code as they pertain to fertilizer rules. The Legislative Council provided a list of questions in an email to the Department on August 27, 2014. Answers to those questions are provided with this testimony along with other supporting documents. The Ag Commissioner is given authority under North Dakota Century Code Chapter 1920.1 to regulate fertilizers. 1920.1-12 provides authority for the Commissioner to adopt rules to implement and enforce the chapter. The Commissioner has never published fertilizer administrative rules before, so these are new. Now, the Department is proposing to create a new article to the North Dakota Administrative Code, which would be Article 715, excuse me. The proposed new rules can be found in pages 3-7 of your supplement. The chapters, Chapter 715-01, found on pages 3-5 of the supplement, establishes investigational allowances to define how much a fertilizer's chemical composition can vary from its label claims before that product is deemed deficient. It is proposed to protect fertilizer consumers to help ensure that they receive the nutrients that they have purchased. The proposed rule is based on national standards developed by the Association of American Plant Food Control Officials. Chapter 715-02, found on pages 6-7 of the supplement, establishes minimum concentrations for micronutrient claims on fertilizer product labeling. For example, it would prohibit a manufacturer from claiming that a fertilizer contained a micronutrient such as boron or iron unless that product contained a minimum amount of that micronutrient. It is intended to protect consumers who purchase micronutrient fertilizer products. And as with Chapter 715-01, the proposed rule is based on national standards developed by APFCO. Also, please note that we had also proposed creating Chapter 715-03, which would have established standards for containment of liquid fertilizer products in certain situations. But upon consideration of the comments, we have decided not to pursue creation of Chapter 715-03. Chairman Devlin and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to discuss the proposed administrative rule changes by our department. Again, I provided written answers to the specific questions posed in Legislative Council's email on August 27th, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Delzer. Would you, I know that you've got it in writing, but would you go through your answer to question 4 a little bit on the one where you decided not to adopt the chapter? Would you give a little more explanation to the committee?
Mr. Chairman, the department received 26 comments on the proposed rules, and if you look towards the end, we've provided a summary of all those comments as well as our written response to them. Most of the comments pertain to Chapter 715-03, the chapter we did not pursue creating. The big reason with that is this was for the primary and secondary containment of liquid fertilizers, and North Dakota Century Code defines only fertilizer distributors, and in that definition it does not really define small independent dealers such as a farmer who might supplement their income by selling small amounts through an independent sales through their farm. And upon review of the comments, the overwhelming cry of that was that the containment, it would have been financially burdensome, and in a worst case scenario could have potentially maybe regulated some of those small entities out of business, and that is not what we wanted to do. So we have decided to consider using a best management practices approach for now to see if that curbs any problems.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Delzer, when you say curbs any problems, can you just give us some sense of what the department's analysis of the problem is in terms of containment? I mean, amount of spills, effect of spills, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, members of the committee, we used health department data. We went back over 10 years and found that there was roughly around 100,000 gallons of liquid fertilizer spilled in North Dakota. And we did not have data pertaining to that on record. We went off of their data. But the other problems, the big problem, I guess, industry had kind of asked for this several times in the past, but there's no industry standards as far as building these new facilities, and parts of the industry want a little more consistency, I guess. When they're building a new facility, they want to know what requirements they need to go off of, so, you know, if rules were established in the future, they wouldn't have to completely rebuild their facility. And that was a big part of the intention of why we wanted to create these.
Mr. Chairman.
You may continue.
Thank you. So then, when you say that you're have made the decision to go toward a best management practice standard instead, has the department defined those best management standards, or is that still a work in progress?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, members of the committee, we have not defined those best management practices yet. We are currently working with NDSU and their engineering department. We are just regulators. We are not experts in the industry and of the standards. So we are consulting with NDSU to have them create the best management practices, which we will distribute.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much. I believe the State Board of Pharmacy is here. We will move on to their presentation, 920 on our agenda, pages 19 to 40.
Chairman Devlin and members of the Administrative Rules Committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss the following rule change with you. For the record, my name is Mark Hardy, Executive Director of the North Dakota Board of Pharmacy. I'm going to answer your questions in the enumerated list and then go through each rule individually on line item 6, if that's okay with you, Chairman. And then if you have any questions, certainly stop me at any time, or else at the end you can ask questions as well. As far as the rules, there's only one rule change that was impacted by a legislative change, and that was the passage of Senate Bill 2342, which codified the fees under the wholesale distributor section of the North Dakota Century Code. The fees that are in the rule are exactly the same as Senate Bill 2342, which was passed by the 63rd Legislative Assembly and signed into law as the governor did then. There's no rules related to federal changes in statutes or legislation. I've included in the packets the public hearing notice as well as the hearing record and a copy of the minutes where these rules were considered and adopted by the Board of Pharmacy. As a general principle, the Board of Pharmacy does go through a fairly extensive process with the profession and interested parties before developing a rule to the extent that we have a public hearing. We actually held a public hearing at the North Dakota Pharmacists Convention in Fargo in April, at which there was many pharmacists and interested parties that were in attendance to voice their support or concerns relative to the rules. The hearing lasted about an hour and a half and addressed each and every rule to give everybody and all interested parties an opportunity to voice their opinions. At the rule hearing, there were a fair amount of comments on a few of these rules. Consideration of the comments is included in the packets for your review, along with the written comments that were received from those interested parties. There were some revisions based on the comments in each individual rule. The cost was for the rules was $3,131.80. And now looking at each rule, on your page 21 and 22, chapter 6102.01-18, the policy and procedure manual required. This rule will require pharmacies to develop and maintain a policy and procedure manual regarding the operation of a pharmacy, depending on the type of, on the particular practice of each pharmacy. There are currently several areas in our current rules that require pharmacies to have a policy and procedure manual for certain tasks. We add a reference to these rule sections in each of the sections of our rules where a policy and procedure manual is required. The intention of this is to that the pharmacy would have one policy and procedure manual that would detail what activities in which the pharmacy conducts. So you'll see on page 23, 24, 26, 31, and 32, there's mention of those specific sections in the addition of the new policy and procedure manual section in there. The Board of Pharmacy feels that the policy and procedure manual is a good thing to ensure continuity of care. Should the staff change, there is a manual to guide the location of pertinent records and also gives them an opportunity to examine and ingest the policies and procedures of a pharmacy based on the issues they may encounter in the operation of the pharmacy. You may note in the regulatory analysis that there was also a rule which would have required a continuous quality improvement protocol be implemented in pharmacies. We did receive an opinion after we submitted the rules to the Attorney General's office, which stated that that we'd have to have a statutory change to protect the discovery of those reportable events that are tracked in a program. And you know, the Board of Pharmacy didn't want to require something that might be discoverable upon a court order and thus held against the pharmacy. The intention of a continuous quality improvement requirement is to for the pharmacy to track those internally and be able to make changes in their overall operations to benefit and have a higher level of safety. Allowing those to be discoverable comes against the intention of having such a thing in place and could have negative consequences on pharmacy. So we'll look at something in the legislature maybe next year to see if there's a section that could be added, and the Attorney General's office gave us a suggestion for that in the rules in the law now. On page 28, chapter 6104.02.01, physician exemption. This rule clarifies some confusion that exists with the current rule requiring an exemption for practitioners to dispense to their patients in short-term situation. This actually expands the ability of a practitioner to dispense specific items in the rule. You'll note that it still does not exempt those practitioners who regularly engage in dispensing from being consistent in the labeling, the counseling, and profile record keeping that we all expect patient would expect to receive at a pharmacy. On page 29 and 30, chapter 6104.08, collaborative agreements, we simply modified the form to allow multiple pharmacists and physicians to be on the collaborative agreement form. The original
form in the rule only allow one pharmacist and one physician to sign, and of course makes it impractical to utilize because most collaborative agreements are between multiple pharmacists and multiple physicians. Collaborative agreements are very common practice now in our health systems, and the Board of Pharmacy and Medical Examiners both jointly approve multiple collaborative agreements in each meeting that we have. On page 35 and 36, administrative inspections. This rule requires an inspection of an out-of-state pharmacy to be licensed to serve patients in North Dakota. Our current practice is to accept an inspection or compliance report of the board of the state in which the pharmacy is actually located. However, it's increasingly come to our attention based on some of the concerns surrounding the compounding issue, specifically the meningitis tragedy that happened in the New England Compounding Center about 2 years ago, that we have some states that do not conduct inspections or compliance visits regularly enough, and also with enough vigorous inspection to account for the complex process of compounding. I actually included in your packet the inspection report of the New England Compounding Center in which the tragedy occurred, and if you note on there, there is no deficiencies at all in the operation in which they were utilizing, and of course we all heard about the meningitis outbreak, and there was some significant concerns that were going on there. So the rule allows us to require that an out-of-state pharmacy that ships compounded prescriptions into North Dakota conduct a qualified inspection once a year. If the pharmacy does not conduct compounding, an inspection should be completed every 2 years under 3B. The National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, which helps all the boards of pharmacies in the individual states, has a program called Verified Pharmacy Program, in which they will conduct an inspection and compliance visits on pharmacies and provides those results to the pharmacies and the state boards of pharmacy so that a thorough inspection is conducted regularly. And we did add that the Verified Pharmacy Program, or VPP, would be an approved third-party inspection process, and currently see many out-of-state pharmacies going through this process, especially in states where they don't get a regular inspection. And also, for your information, our pharmacies, we typically get to all our pharmacies within a year's time period. Under 3C, rogue internet pharmacies continue to be a major concern with counterfeited prescription medications being entered into the marketplace, which of course puts the public at risk. Nearly all the sites that are brought to our attention are rogue and do not hold a license to practice pharmacy. However, there are some legitimate internet pharmacy practices that solicit prescriptions on the internet, and this would require those legitimate ones to go through a compliance program provided by the Verified Internet Pharmacy Practice Sites, or VIPS, that's administered by the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. And for those conducting internet veterinary prescription, there's also a program called Vet VIPS. These compliance visits are nothing new, and they're not specific to North Dakota, and there's many pharmacies that participate in these programs. But this provides a pharmacy that wishes to licensure in many states to have a uniform inspection to provide to multiple boards of pharmacy. And of course, this provides a level of safety to our residents that the pharmacies which are licensed are safe and well vetted to provide their prescriptions to our residents. Of course, a lot of this is going to be notification to those currently licensed pharmacies, and we very well intend to, and we have been educating those new licensees that we have had that there is going to be possibly be a requirement in the future for this. On page 27 through 28, chapter, now it's a typo, it says 38, 27 and 28, chapter 611101 is fees, and as I mentioned earlier, we've inserted the fees consistent with Senate Bill 2342, as passed by the 63rd Legislative Assembly. The reason for the fees in the legislative bill was to cover the deficits the board endured in operating the prescription drug monitoring program. And lastly, on page 39 and 40, chapter 611201, this updates the software standard for which pharmacies report controlled substance prescriptions to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program database.
And lastly, chapter 61-1201-04, required use for certain dispensing situation. This section is new and would require a dispenser to access and view a prescription drug monitoring program report before dispensing pain or anxiety medication when a patient is new to the pharmacy, receiving the medications for long-term or abuse is suspected. As indicated, regulatory analysis was prepared, number 7, for tentative rules and anticipated cost more than $50,000 across the state of North Dakota. The one was the requirement for an audit of pharmacies to have an inspection, and then the continuous quality improvement rule. And of course, one of the caveats was that we did scale back the continuous quality improvement rule based on the opinion of the Attorney General's office. A regulatory analysis or economic impact statement was not required and was not issued. We do anticipate these rules to have a fiscal impact on the Board of Pharmacy, and I did attach the fiscal note, which was attached to Senate Bill 2342, which mirrors the changes in the fees. The rest of the rules will have no significant financial impact on the Board of Pharmacy, and there was no constitutional taking assessment prepared as it did not apply. And lastly, none of these were emergency rules.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hardy, I'm just curious, as I was looking through your packet, I see a piece of correspondence dated April 16th from CVS, and I'm just curious, it has to do with the in-state licensing and so on of a supervising pharmacist, if I'm using the correct term there. And, you know, I realize that they are a bit of a unique animal in our state, being one of two, if I'm not mistaken, which were grandfathered into our pharmacy ownership law and so on. So I realize they operate in a different structure, perhaps, than many of our locally owned pharmacies. How does this rule affect entities like that? And I know that's an issue that's going to be, as I understand it, on the ballot, so it could change drastically across the state. How did you respond to this concern?
Yeah, Chairman Devlin and Chairman Koppelman. The issue for CVS Caremark was not so much their in-state pharmacies, you know, because we get out to those pharmacies and inspect them on a yearly basis. It more had to do with the out-of-state pharmacies, so their mail order facilities in which they utilize the ship-in prescriptions in the state, or maybe border pharmacies that they have in Moorhead that they have licensed. So that was the, I believe, the context of their comments that they provided to us.
I see. Okay, thank you. That clarifies. And just to add on to that, then, how is it handled with border areas? For example, Fargo, Moorhead, Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, if they're Wahpeton, Breckenridge, whatever it might be, if there's a Minnesota licensed pharmacist doing something across the river, how does that work?
Yeah, Chairman Devlin and Representative Koppelman, they would still have to have an inspection. Likely, most of those places that are along the border are typical retail pharmacies where they're not conducting compounding into the state, so we require them to have an inspection every 2 years. And for those surrounding states, Minnesota, South Dakota, Montana, there should be no problem with that. Those states do vigorous inspections on a yearly basis, so we should have no concerns there.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Solanego.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardy, not necessarily related to what you've discussed, but in the last couple of weeks there's been a change in federal regulations where individuals can return prescription drugs to pharmacies. And can you just maybe update us a little bit on where we're at there?
Chairman Devlin and Representative Silvernagel, I'd love to do that. We've been waiting for this rule from the DEA, and to give you a little bit of overview for those that may not be familiar with it, the rule would allow pharmacies that have a current DEA registration to sign up to be take-back locations for patients. So currently the system and how it works is that a patient can't bring controlled substance medications back to the pharmacy to have them destroyed. They need to take them back to the police office or participate in what's called a DEA take-back day, which is pretty impractical for a patient to utilize. So we've been pushing for this for a while, in which patients will be able to take the medications back and have a system in place that they could do that. Now, continuing on with that, we've actually had conversations with the Attorney General's office, and through what we referred to as the Prescription Drug Abuse Advisory Committee, which is a bunch of interested associations, boards, and that, about this impending rule. And the Board of Pharmacy intends to have as many pharmacies participate in the state as possible to get these take-back locations set up so patients can take their medications back to get them out of out of the house or out of the medicine cabinet in those unused medication situations. So you'll probably be seeing a pretty large rollout of that. We've had conversations with a company in Fargo, HESI, which has a DEA-approved incinerator, about making boxes to place in the pharmacies, which would be securely fastened in the pharmacy in which patients could bring back medications. So we look forward to that. Does that answer your question? Yep, thank you.
Further questions, Senator Heckman?
Mr. Chairman, Mike, do these same rules that you have here apply to Indian Health Service pharmacies?
Chairman Devlin and Senator Heckman, there's yes and no on that. The Indian Health Service pharmacies that do not participate with IHS, and they have their own health care. I can't remember, it's 501, or they have a specific number in which they defer out of the federal system but just take the money to administer their own health care, which would be the example in the reservation. Can't think of it now. Up north, the Elbowoods, that facility up in there, that Indian reservation along the Skokalia. They have that, so that would apply. Those are state-licensed pharmacies with us. They have to license in the state, although the ones in Turtle Mountains, which are federal facilities, those wouldn't apply to the rules. They don't exist as state licenses.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hardy, on page 39 and continuing over to 40, you're talking about prior to dispensing prescriptions for pain, and there's a variety of things that would trigger having to request and review the prescription drug monitoring report. And one of the last one under E on page 40 is presenting a prescription for reported drugs when the patient resides outside the usual pharmacy geographic patient population.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking here of legislators.
Yep.
If we come to Bismarck and we want to fill a prescription in Bismarck, but we live, you know, somewhere else, are we going to be subject to this? I mean, will somebody have to do that? And so just tell us how long it takes to get one of these monitoring reports.
Well, Chairman Devlin and Senator Triplett, you know, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program is an online database in which a practitioner, a pharmacist can go online and request a patient profile and view that within a few seconds. So it's very quick, you know, and it's, we have 76% of our pharmacists that have accounts set up, so, you know, it's not a change in what they're used to. To answer your specific question about whether you would get looked up if you're presenting a prescription in Bismarck, the answer is probably yes. You know, that's something that a pharmacist should look. If the patient isn't from around the area, or the prescriber isn't from around the area, that's a red flag for a pharmacist to say, well, we better just make sure. You know, there's, in 85-90% of cases, it's no problem, but it's obviously a red flag because patients do travel. When we first started the prescription drug monitoring program, we had a way that we could drill down reports, and there was a patient that was using 22 prescribers and 30 pharmacies within the last 6 months, and they were dotted all around the state of North Dakota. So that patient was traveling around looking for prescribers and dispensers. So that is something that is utilized for that. So,
if I may follow up, then just,
you may continue.
Just how exactly do you define outside of a geographic area? I mean, what outside the usual pharmacy geographic prescriber care area? What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, it's pretty broad. Excuse me, Chairman Devlin and Senator Triplett. It's pretty broad. You know, I think we defer to the pharmacist's judgment in that, what that exactly means. I would say in Fargo that may just mean Fargo, but in Carrington, North Dakota, that may be a bigger area. You know, so it's a little bit tricky to nail down. We wanted to leave that up to the pharmacist's judgment as to what that would eventually be. So, yep.
Compliment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hardy, speaking of updates, I'm just kind of curious, I noticed you have a fee schedule in here for the wholesale drug pedigree program, and I'm just curious, now that that's all had a chance to kind of mature and settle in a little bit, how is it working and what are your observations?
Chairman Devlin and Representative Compliment, there's been
some federal changes on that too. You know, we were, you know, as you're well aware, that we're working on the drug pedigree and the track and trace technology, electronic track and trace, and when the federal government just recently passed a law called the Drug Quality and Security Act that did some work with the electronic pedigree, and they pushed the requirements back, and they specifically said in there that they were superseding any state requirements, and so these states wouldn't be able to have electronic track and trace until 2020. And most of us think that it's to preempt California, and the federal legislature determined that they wanted to preempt that, so that was the only model that those interested parties could go about doing that. And so that is still a work in action, and hopefully over time, you know, as executive director of the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy says, you know, if we can track the pair of jeans that you bought and you can bring it back and know where they came from and everything else, there should be no reason why we can't do that with drugs too. So that is coming hopefully sooner than later, but it's been pushed back. As far as the implementation of the actual law, which included some stuff on durable medical equipment retailers and distributors, that's been going very well, and it seems to be going very well from our perspective. So
you may continue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So without the electronic piece that you were talking about, is it still very workable in terms of the drug pedigree tracking? And I realize you can't do it with that electronic monitor you were talking about.
Yeah, Chairman Devlin and Representative Koppelman, it is it's still doable, but it's not doable to the micro level in which it's probably necessary to help prevent some of the counterfeit medications that are out there. And it's, you hear some stories, it's, and the business schemes of it, it's pretty troubling. So we're hoping that comes sooner or later, and we look forward to it. So
further questions from the committee?
I have one.
Mr. Walstead.
Mr. Hardy, as you correctly stated, the fee schedule for manufacturer, distributor, warehouse, wholesale, etc., does precisely replicate the statutory schedule for those entities that was in Senate Bill 2342. My question, I guess, would be why replicate in rule what is in statute? And the problem would be if the statute gets tweaked by even $1 amount next session, you've got to do a new rulemaking to change your number in this schedule. And I also believe there's a statutory provision that says the Attorney General shall not approve administrative rules that simply duplicate statutory language. So.
Yeah, Chairman Devlin and Mr. Walstead, that was, it's a little bit puzzling to me too, and that's the way the Board of Pharmacy's always done it, and that's how at that time Executive Director Anderson wanted to proceed with it. The intention of having in the rules is a one place, one-stop shop for them to find out where the fees are, but I can agree with your point that it is kind of duplicative when you have it in the legislature. The intention we wanted to go to the legislature with the fees is so that, you know, everybody had a say in it and it was properly vetted instead of doing it through a rulemaking process. So, but yeah, I don't disagree with you there as far as being kind of onerous as far as having to change it if the legislature did change it in the future.
Follow up?
You may.
Mr. Hardy, my other question is there anything in these rules that's going to get you and me subpoenaed to a criminal trial again?
Chairman Devlin and Mr. Walstead, I really hope not. A little background on that, yeah, we have a...
well, just for the committee's information, Mr. Hardy and I and a whole bunch of other people from the Attorney General's office and elsewhere have been subpoenaed. There was supposed to be a criminal trial in Stutzman County in August on an individual who was charged with a violation of, what's it called, designer drugs?
Yeah, synthetic drugs.
Synthetic drugs. Shortly before last session, emergency rules came through here on those designer drugs, and And the legislature followed that up with emergency legislation that did the same thing. The emergency legislation became effective under an emergency clause on March 15th. This guy got arrested on March 13th. So he's under the rule, and the prosecutor has subpoenaed everyone who touched those rules in any way to show up for this trial, which is now rescheduled for November.
Yeah.
We haven't got a date yet, but we're still hanging.
In the middle of deer season. Yeah, and just for your chairman, if I may, you know, if you remember the synthetic drug issue that we dealt with in the legislature you guys passed, and also as administrative rules, it's been tremendously successful in cutting down the amount of synthetic drugs. I mean, they're still coming through on the internet and those kind of things, but the amount of head shops and that were participating in the state has been dramatically reduced, and the amount of samples that the crime lab is testing is substantially lower. So kudos to you for putting that into place in a quick fashion, and it really made a difference and saved a lot of lives, in my personal opinion. So,
further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Committee, we will move on to the presentation of the Education Standards and Practice Board, which is your pages 41 to 94.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Administrative Rules Committee. I'm Janet Welk, Executive Director of the Education Standards and Practices Board, and wish to testify on the rules published in the October 2014 supplement to the North Dakota Administrative Code. This rule change resulted from the board realizing the need for changes in licensure requirements to help facilitate schools and districts securing qualified teachers for North Dakota. The procedures used in adopting the rules included the letter of intent to amend on December 16th of 2013, letter sent to legislators on December 23rd, publication in the North Dakota Newspaper Association December 25th through the 31st, a public hearing on January 24th at the board offices at 2718 Gateway Avenue, Suite 303. No one attended that hearing, written public comment until February 7th, and we received no written comments. We had final acceptance March 6th of 2014 by the board, examination by the Attorney General's office April 28th, and final submission for review on May 13th of 2014. The rule is not expected to have an impact on regulated community in excess of 50,000. There was no regulatory analysis completed. Approximate cost was $3,500, and there was rules do not have any physical effect on state revenues or expenditures. A constitutional taking assessment was not prepared. If there are any questions, concerns, I would be happy to answer at this time.
Janet, could you be kind enough to give us a little more breakdown on the specific changes that had to be made? I know the board can, or the committee can read them. Those of us that aren't on the education committees may not completely understand what you did, but could you just, you don't have to go in depth, but at least briefly give us a breakdown of what changes were needed and what you did. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, most definitely. Basically, three changes. One was the board added a late fee that was actually recommended by the Attorney General's office about a year ago. So we added a late fee. It's done electronically because our application process is all electronic. That's the first page that you will see. Secondly, we added language from the Senate bill last session that said we would accept any endorsement on a teacher's license coming in from another state. And so we've added that to our rules. Thirdly, because of that rule, we added and allowed, and this has been well received in the field, if a teacher has held a license in North Dakota for 2 years, graduated from an approved educator preparation program, they can take the praxis test and test into another content area. Prior to this, the only way teachers could get into another content area was from the old 1960 law. It was either a major or a minor. That was changed up a bit by the federal government in 2001 when we had NCLB passed. Now, teachers can, if they've gone through a regular preparation program, test into a different content area, which is helping with our shortages across the state. Ironically, the first person to do it, which surprised us, because as an educator, I like to think that you have to have at least had some coursework to be able to move from one content area to a different content area. But ironically, the first teacher to do it was from Rugby. He was a social studies teacher, and they needed, or they were preparing for some additional growth in their ag program. And so they had the social studies teacher take the ag test, and he passed it. So it was kind of interesting, but his background was, he had grown up on a family farm. His family owns a bison production. He had been through FFA all of his high school years, and so he had a good background. Second, we had a paraeducator that it was a prepared English teacher here in the Bismarck District, had been working as a para in a special ed classroom, and took the special ed test and passed. We've had about 30, 35 teachers in North Dakota that have now taken tests in different content areas and passed them.
Question, Senator Heckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Janet. When I read through here, it talks a lot about minor equivalencies, and my understanding is that that went by the wayside. Can you tell the committee here who can teach with a minor equivalency in the state of North Dakota, or what you can teach?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckman, minor equivalencies are not allowed in the core subject areas, and that's based on federal law. And that's social studies, science, math, English language arts, music, and foreign languages. What there was a loophole in that NCLB law in 2001, which says that if board approved, someone can be working toward becoming highly qualified if they can get it done in 3 years. And so we still use those minor equivalencies. We put them on what we call a TAFE endorsement. We allow them to have a minor or 16 semester hours, take 3 years to become highly qualified. With that option, now they would also be able to test. And we still use minors in PE, all of the career technical, business, marketing, speech, some of those areas as well.
Further questions, Senator Andrus?
Mr. Chairman and Janet, because we're having such a dreadful time filling teacher openings, I applaud you for your work to make this easier. But on page 48, and I shared these rules with my local superintendent to see if he had any concerns, and he didn't understand why it seems like you've added a loophole in subsection 6 on page 48. A special education major for a regular licensure who exceeds the teacher education program approval standards must now also include a second major. Do you have an explanation why that new loophole is on, or do I misunderstand it, and did he misunderstand it?
Committee, I believe that's on page 46 in the booklet you have.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Andrus, I did visit with your superintendent, and he also complimented the board for their work in helping to alleviate shortages. This basically is for people graduating in North Dakota if they want to be highly qualified and more marketable. We still issue what we call a license to the, what we call the standalone major. So if someone just has a special ed major and they don't have the elementary ed to go with it, we will still license them. It's under a different section of the rule under restricted licenses. But this is in conjunction with being considered highly qualified. When the special ed federal law was aligned to NCLB, the special educators in the nation felt that special ed children or children with special needs deserve to have highly qualified teachers as well as all other children. And so that's why we added that.
This is, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue.
You may continue.
This is a particularly difficult field to fill. Their finding is, as we found out in the last meeting of this committee, you know. The other question I have, which is it's not related to the rules themselves, is wouldn't it be possible for you to have in your notification process to add most of the superintendents around the state who are dealing with this licensure or one other person if on the larger districts who handle the hiring to send a copy of the rules to them? I asked him why he hadn't seen these rules himself. He said they weren't submitted to him. I don't understand why his school administrators association didn't forward them to him, but it does seem to me that it would be a shortcut and advantageous if your agency did it in the future.
Mr. Chairman, we can do that.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Janet, for being here.
Thank you.
Committee, we've cleared the room, which is usually a good thing, but we're a little ahead of schedule. I'm going to give you the break now. We'll come back in at 10 to 10. We have notified the people that we're ahead of schedule, and I'm assuming at 10 to we'll be ready to go.
Clean your screen. It's driving me nuts.
I never have my thing.
Hey, I'm not looking at your stuff. I just see the screen.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
I never have my thing with me because I don't carry it in a bag.
Well, you gotta get a satchel.
Committee will return to order. We will have a presentation by the Public Service Commission regarding their rules, which appear on pages 95 to 100 of your book. You may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Deitch, Director of the Public Service Commission's Reclamation Division.
Excuse me, just hold on. Did everybody get a copy? Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, these rule changes are pertain to North Dakota Administrative Code Section 6905.2-12-04 pertaining to surface coal mining. In response to
Mr. Deutsch, I may have missed this, but you started, but if you didn't, would you please again, for the chairman's sake, identify yourself for the record so that we have it in the
yes.
thing? Thank you.
Yes, I'm Jim Deitch, Director of Reclamation Division for the Public Service Commission.
No.
And these rules, they're going to pertain to surface coal mining and reclamation operations. With regard to the questions that were asked, these rule changes were not mandated by any statutory changes. The rules are related to federal rules. Mining and reclamation rules adopted by the commission are part of the coal regulatory program that must be effective as counterpart regulations adopted by the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation Enforcement within the Department of the Interior. North Dakota's reclamation law is based on the Federal Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977. However, these particular changes were not mandated by the Office of Surface Mining, and they were optional. As far as the rulemaking procedure, on January 22, 2011, the Commission issued the notice of intent to adopt and amend administrative rules and the notice of the public hearing. The notice for the rulemakings were published in daily papers throughout the newspaper as required by North Dakota Century Code Chapter 2832. And the public hearing was held August 11th at the Commission hearing room here in Bismarck. At the conclusion of the hearing, the Commission allowed a 10-day comment period for anyone to comment on the proposed rules that would be part of the record for this case. Following receipt of the Attorney General's opinion, that on January 18th, 2011, the proposed rule changes were then submitted to the Office of Surface Mining in February as for approval as a formal amendment to our program. Again, the OSM also published a notice in the Federal Register about these rule changes, and that occurred in April of 2012. However, it took until June 6th of this year, 2014, until OSM finally approved these rule changes. So that's the reason for the lengthy delay from the time we proposed and held the hearing and until we're proposing to adopt them at this time. With regard to comments on the proposed rules, we only received comments from BNI Coal. They provided both oral and written comments, and they requested an additional change to a proposed rule that deals with letters of credit that are used to back a collateral bond for surface coal mining permits. Following receipt of those comments, we did make some other changes to the proposed rule, and those changes are incorporated into the package. With regard to the cost of this rulemaking, the notice is we had another rulemaking proceeding for another PSC division, and so the cost was split between the two cases, and the cost for this was roughly half of that, or right around a little less than $1,000. As I mentioned, the proposed changes pertain to letters of credit that are pledged as the collateral, if that form of collateral bond is used by a mining company to meet its performance bond requirements. The specific changes involve financial information and notices that banks issuing a letter of credit must provide to the commission. An option is being added to allow a bank to provide a certified copy of a financial report that is already required by a federal agency in place of a balance sheet that would have to be certified by a certified public accountant. Another change relates to notices that banks must give if the commission must give the commission if there are actions alleging insolvency or bankruptcy of that bank. And this is just being revised to require that notice only to the extent allowed by state or federal banking regulations. And I mentioned BNI Coal requested these changes because some of the banks they do business with would not issue letters of credit under the rules as they were in existence right now. Question 7, with regard to regulatory analysis. A copy of that is attached to the handout, and these rules are not expected to have an impact on the regulatory community in excess of $50,000. The economic impact statement of impact on small entities, we address that as well, and that's included in the attachment, and there again, this is not expected to have any impact there. Question 9, with regard to fiscal effect on state revenues and expenditures, these rules do not have any effect on revenues or expenditures by the state. And we also conducted the takings assessment, and that's attached as well. And the final questions, whether or not these were adopted as emergency rules, they were not, considering the time we proposed and felt we're finally looking at having them become effective. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody may have.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Deutsch, just a curiosity question. Did you get any explanation from the Office of Surface Mining why it took them so long to publish the notice in the Federal Register?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Triplett, what we heard that there were delays in getting the legal review by the Solicitor's Office, which is separate from the staff of the Office of Surface Mining. And it's just workload that they have been dealing with, a number of lawsuits and staffing issues and the like, so.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It would appear we have about an hour set aside for Department of Human Services. Are they ready?
Of course we are, Mr. Chairman. We only have one set of rules this time. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Julie Lear. I'm an attorney with the Department of Human Services. We have one set of rules for you today, and the proposed amendments are to North Dakota Administrative Code Chapters 7503, 23, and 24. They are not related to statutory changes made by the Legislative Assembly, but they are the result of an appropriation, part of them are the result of an appropriation provided in the Department's appropriation bill from 2013. At the June meeting of this committee, the department requested and received an extension for these rules. The rules are not related to changes in federal statutes or regulations. You can see under 3 what we do for our notice requirements. Paragraph 4, we did have one set of written comments that we received, and we made one change in the rules as a result of those written comments. The summary is attached to the report. The cost of giving the notice, holding the hearing, etc., was just a little bit north of $2,300. The proposed rules amend chapters 7503.23 and 7503.24. A lot of the changes that we made were clarification or revision, just to kind of clean up the rules for a certain extent. Probably the heart of the rules, the ones that are probably the greatest impact to services, are under section 7503.23.05, explained on page 3 of my testimony, and 7503.23.06. Specifically, those are the provision of extended personal cares under the service payments to the elderly and disabled program, and also provision of home-delivered meals to certain clients under the service payments for elderly and disabled program. under 7503-2306, you'll see that we also have allowance for the provision of supervision to clients with cognitive or physical impairment under the Medicaid waiver program. The change that we made in response to the summary of comments was to section 7503-2315. And we received a comment from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they thought that there was an ambiguity in the language that we were adding, so we added some clarifying language, because we certainly don't want the administrative law judges to be confused on what our rules mean. So we heed their warnings. Rules are expected to have an impact on the regulated community in excess of $50,000. We have prepared regulatory analysis, small entity regulatory analysis, small entity economic impact. The fiscal impact resulting from the implementation of the amendments was anticipated in the department's budget. The estimated fiscal impact is $676,255, of which $431,329 is general fund. Those are basically the three programs that I called out for you when I was describing the rules. Prior to the implementation of the changes in subsection 14 of 7503-2306, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services must also approve those changes. Last week we were advised by CMS that the proposed rate for services needs to be reviewed to ensure compliance with provisions of the Social Security Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act. Department staff is in the process of analyzing the rate. It may be necessary to increase the proposed rate. Based on the results of the analysis and the time needed by CMS for final review and approval, it is also possible that the services to be provided under the changes proposed to subsection 14 may not be implemented on October 1, 2014. Constitutional takings assessment was prepared and the rules were not adopted as emergency rules. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them or defer to my support group for help.
Question from the committee. Senator Heckman, did you have a question?
Yep, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Julie, when I look at these rules, are these rules expanding or contracting current services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckman, I believe they're expanding them. I'm getting nods from everybody behind me, so that's good.
Okay, can I continue, please? The reason I asked about that is I received a call from one of my constituents, and the client that they have is, as the client ages, happens to live in their home, and their health deteriorates, their number of hours, service hours, has been cut down by the department. And they contacted me asking about why would those service hours be cut down as the client needs, as they need to do more care for that individual. And I didn't know, I couldn't answer them whether it was because of the upcoming new administrative rules or what. So.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Heckman, just from generally speaking, I don't think it's because of these rules. It could be because the analysis undertaken by the county or the report they're continuing the review would be to authorize services. But I don't think it's the result of the changes here. I think that it's the result of the review by the county. And
like an example would be like laundry used to be included. Now they can't do laundry. They don't get paid for doing laundry. Purchasing food, because the food is done in the home, they can't do that anymore, and the client can't get out and do it. And I was just wondering if that was these rules. So we'll check with the county and see what's going on. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckman, we'd be happy to visit with you kind of offline on that. Like I said, I don't think that these rules are making those types of wholesale changes.
Okay.
I think that there's something that's changed in that person's situation that's probably result common.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Didn't mean to wake anybody up there. Oh, Julie, this is too easy. Too easy. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and we do appreciate all the efforts and work. I've just looked at the statistics, and we see that you spent a considerable amount of time with us this interim, and we appreciate all your guidance and your assistance in that regard as well.
That may be a statement we've never heard of administrative rules that we appreciate from a state agency, but thank you very much. Committee, if council is caught up, we'll need the presentation by legislative council staff of the rulemaking statistics. You should have that in front of you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the memo that you see is one that's done every 2 years, and it signifies the last meeting of the committee prior to its report to the legislative management, these statistics will be incorporated in the final report that goes to legislative management. And every 2 years, this information ends up in the legislative management report book. So it's preserved for all history, how much homework you've had to do this interim. And if you scan over the numbers in these two charts, the upper chart relates to the number of sections of administrative rules either created or amended or repealed, and that number, as you can see, is up a fair amount from the previous interim, but 11 and 12 looks like the good old days on here, 907 sections. But if you look down at the next chart, this is the number of pages of rules that you had to read. And 11 and 12 was not really the good old days. There was a lot more pages of rules, even though it was a fewer number of sections. So it's always hard to tell exactly what we can read from this, because some agency rules, as you know, and I'm thinking particularly of any environmental rules from the Department of Health, clean air, clean water, all that stuff, those sections can go on and on and on and on, and 15 pages, you keep looking for a period to end a sentence, and it's not there till the very end. Statistically, I'm not sure what it means, but I do believe that we can discern that back about 94 to 96, something happened that kind of reduced rulemaking activity. And I think some of you recall that what that thing was the authority of this committee to carry over and potentially void rules. It seemed to have made a substantial difference on agency behavior on when to make rules and how extensive those rulemaking proceedings could be. This meeting marks 20 years that I have been staffing this committee, and that's a record I expect never to be broken. And I'm sure Vonnette's ambition doesn't include breaking that record. But in the time that I've been doing this, that has made a lot of difference. And I have to compliment the people that have served on this committee over that time in judiciously using that authority. As you know, Julie, don't listen. There are some constitutional issues with that authority. And the committee has judiciously used that authority to encourage agencies to work with concerned people, come back with a recommendation for some changes in the rules that have almost always worked out to mutual satisfaction of everybody. And I think if push came to shove and we ended up in court, we might lose that authority. So Representative K. Koppelman doesn't think so. I don't know about the Koppelman, anyway, I just want to compliment the committee for wielding that sword with a little discretion. Anyway, that was a speech that has nothing to do with these statistics. That's the report on your homework assignments for this interim and successfully completed. At this point, we have nothing to carry over, but we're not done yet.
On that very subject, Representative Koppelman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I get to that, I do have a motion to make, but I just want to comment. I'm sure maybe the chairman has appropriate comments to make about this, but I just want to say how appreciative those of us that have served on this committee and enjoyed Mr. Walstead's leadership and tutelage and and protection and guidance all these years, because in fact, dating back to that very law change that he talked about, and then some that were made subsequently that many of you were all involved in, I think he's given us very wise counsel, and this committee would not, and its work would not be what it is without him. So, Bennett, you have big shoes to fill, but it's nice to know he'll be in the background whispering in your ear if you ever have questions or concerns. Mr. Chairman, I would like to call the committee's attention to a section of the rules that the Education Standards and Practices Board presented. And on page 46, the question that Senator Andrus asked, I think, was very instructive. And in fact, I was looking at that section before he raised the question, and I think I was equally concerned by the answer as I was by reading the section and the question. And that is that, you know, it appears to me, and this is the one that has to do with special education, well, let me just read real quickly. In item 6 there, it says, the special education major for regular license meeting or exceeding the teacher education program approval standards must include a second major in early childhood, elementary, middle level, or secondary education. While I appreciate most of what we heard today from ESPB and many of you who were on this committee last interim, recall discussions we had with them, kind of dragging them kicking and screaming into the reciprocity world after we'd passed legislation saying they must, which they were ignoring prior to that. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm really pleased with their approach and the direction they're going. But when I look at this, I think this is a fence-building measure. And as I understood the answer to Senator Andrus' question, it was that when No Child Left Behind was passed and highly qualified certification was required for various subject areas, the special ed teachers thought there should be that for them too. And so that's kind of where this came from. My concern is, as Senator Andrus mentioned, this is an area that we're having trouble hiring people in. We're having trouble with people coming into our state that are qualified to do this elsewhere, being recognized by our ESPB to do what they're doing historically. And I just think to add another layer at this point is really counterintuitive when they're doing the testing and all that for additional teaching ability in other areas. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we hold this paragraph, this little piece of the section of the rules, over until our next meeting so we can get better clarification on what's happening with that.
You've heard the motion. Is there a second? Senator Andrus?
Yes, Mr.
You want to second it, and then we can have some discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll second that motion.
Okay. Senator Andrus, did you have some further comments on it?
Well, yes. You know, the whole purpose of this section is to help deal with our teacher shortage, according to Janet's own testimony. And yet this is another hoop that says, if you passed everything, every other requirement, you also have to have something else. And so, to me, I think it's just added another hoop to jump through, and it probably won't affect very many schools, but if it denied one teacher who was qualified under the rules otherwise, might be denied a position, and some schools going to be left wanting.
Senator Heckerman?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm going to give you my interpretation of what this means, and I wish Janet would have been able, wish the motion would have been made while she was here. I have special ed credentials. Excuse me. I also have a secondary teaching degree. And my special education credentials mean that I can go in and teach anyone in K through 12 in learning disabilities, intellectual disabilities, and emotional disturbances. I can go and work with them on a daily basis and any of those grade levels. However, I cannot assign a grade to them at any of those grade levels because I'm only a secondary teacher. And so, to me, what I interpret this as and what I was taught that I could do is, because I have a secondary math degree, that's one area where if a student was pulled out of Algebra 1 or general math because they had a math disability, I could then take them into my classroom. I could teach that math class to them, and I could assign a grade to them. I can't do that with elementary students in math because I'm not qualified. And so that's my understanding of when I just finished teaching is what you can and can't do. So I think she said today that you could still, she can still certify special education teachers. In other words, I can work with an elementary student that has a math disability, but I need to be working with the classroom teacher on what I'm doing and what that teacher needs me to work with the student on, and then the teacher will assign the grade to that student. Maybe I pull the student out the last 10 minutes of the class period every day and work with them. So to me, it's more like when you can give a credit and when you can't give a credit, and that's why I wish we would have done this motion when Janet would have been here to explain a little bit more. But that was my interpretation of when I could allow a credit or provide a credit to a student and when I couldn't. I have to have that elementary degree if I'm a special education teacher in order to give a grade to that student in elementary spelling or whatever, if they are dyslexic in spelling. Well.
Senator Tripp.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I, this is sort of a follow-up to Senator Heckerman's comment. I didn't make a note, and I'm sorry I didn't, but I, when Senator Andrus asked the question, I do recall Ms. Welk responding by saying that there was another section in the rules that allowed licensure or certification in a different way, so maybe this question is actually for Senator Heckerman. Is that kind of what you're talking about? I mean, did you hear her say that, and how did you interpret her comment in response to Senator Andrus' question?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tripp, that's what I'm understanding. Because I can go and I can get a master's in special education, and that allows me certification in certain areas. And then I can work with those students that have a learning disability or intellectual disability, but I cannot assign them a grade. I can still work with them, and I can still get licensed for the state of North Dakota. And I can provide special education services in Stanley and Newtown and Bismarck and Fargo. But if I'm going to assign a grade to that student, then I must have that other accreditation. I have to be a teacher in a specific area to do that. And that was my interpretation of what I've done in the past, but maybe I still think that that's the way that the law reads. But, and if we want to hold this over, that's fine, but I don't think it's going to change the rule any. And I think the rule needs to be there. I mean, I think that needs to be the rule that the schools follow. And it's because No Child Left Behind, you have to be highly qualified. So highly qualified, if I'm going to teach a middle school language arts program, means I have to have certification in language arts in the middle school, which would mean an elementary teaching degree.
Representative Koppelman, did you have a follow-up or maybe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do, but I see that Representative Owens is raising his hand too. But Mr. Chairman, my only comment is, I'm not moving that the rule be voided. I'm just moving that it be held over for precisely the reasons we're hearing. That I for one need a little more clarification. And you know, if Senator Heckerman is correct, and as far as making the motion now, that's I think generally what we do. Very seldom have I heard a motion made at the time when the people are in the room, although it's possible certainly. But so there was no ill will intended there. It's just that as I looked at this, I thought it was a concern. Secondly, I think the alternative that was referred to, if I understood her correctly, is that Ms. Welk said she could issue a restricted license. Now, my understanding, and I'm in a long time since I was an educator, but my understanding of a restricted license is that it's sort of a provisional measure so that you can come up to speed in your education or some other requirement before your license is full or complete or whatever the term, permanent, whatever the term might be. So I don't think, I think what she's saying, and I know that was some of the discussion we had last interim, is that we'll give you this to allow you to limp along while we require you to do what we require you to do. So I don't think it's that they can be licensed somewhere else and that this is just for a certain specific narrow area, but I could be wrong, and that's why I'm willing to have her come back. And I don't think, since this is an enhanced requirement, I don't think holding it over has any ill effect, because it just leaves in effect whatever is current. Secondly, I think that, I agree with everything that's been said in terms of beefing things up, being more marketable, having more ability to grade, whatever it might be, but this says must.
So this is a requirement, not a, you know, not an ability to improve your credential.
Senator Andrist.
My concern, and again, to amplify it, is this doesn't seem to me to be addressing what Senator Hickman said, is the procedure now for grading and all this. That must be encompassed someplace else if it's part of the requirement. This just simply says it's one more thing they have to have in order to be licensed. And that's what concerned my superintendent.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the point the senator was making, and that intrigued me because I wasn't going to say anything until she brought that up. And I can appreciate the point of having somebody working in special ed and not being able to assign a grade, and then you can assign the grade if you're also licensed in that part. But then you inferred that what was being said, and I could completely support this, quite frankly, is you have the option of you can be licensed in the secondary or elementary and you can do the grade, or you can work with somebody else, be the special ed teacher, and then they could assign the grade based on your work. Completely support that. But the reason that I'm having problems with this is the word must. This doesn't leave an option. This says must. And that's, and so, I wish she was here.
Further comments from the committee before we vote? I don't see a problem with having to come back to explain it, because there's obviously questions from the committee, and but this, I assume, John, is that the roll call vote? No, you didn't tell me that. Okay. No further questions from the committee. May poll the committee on holding over this particular section for some clarification.
Representative Devlin.
Yes.
Representative Bainey.
Yes.
Representative Boshi.
Yes.
Representative Franzbach.
Yes.
Representative Hiller.
Yes.
Representative B. Koppelman.
Yes.
Representative K. Koppelman.
Yes.
Representative Owens.
Yes.
Representative Schatz.
Yes.
Representative Silbernagel.
Yes.
Representative Tolman.
Yes.
Senator Armstrong.
Yes.
Senator Andrist.
Yes.
Senator Hickman.
No.
Senator Klein. And Senator Triplett?
No.
That motion carries, Mr. Chairman. The language in just that one subdivision of the rules would be carried over, and we will notify ESPB that that will be on the December agenda.
Thank you, John. Representative Koppelman and Senator Andrist, perhaps you could share in an email your concerns with John, just to make sure we know exactly, you know, where you're at with it, and then he can draft the letter to them. Committee discussion and directives. Other than that, do you know anything?
Oh yeah,
I was afraid of that.
Go ahead. Good. You and I have to do a book report. At the end of the interim, a motion needs to be made and approved that the chairman and the staff prepare and deliver the committee's final interim report to legislative management at the November meeting. In addition, most interim committees do an adjourned sine die. This committee doesn't do that, so don't make that motion, because this committee cannot take itself off the hook. This job is like permanent. However, a motion for the report of the committee to legislative management would be in order.
Senator Hickman, second by Representative Silbernagel. Any discussion? Poll the committee.
Representative Devlin.
Yes.
Representative Bainey.
Yes.
Representative Boshi.
Yes.
Representative Franzbach.
Yes.
Representative Heller.
Yes.
Representative B. Koppelman.
Yes.
Representative K. Koppelman. Representative Owens.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Schatz.
Yes.
Representative Silbernagle.
Yes.
Representative Tolman.
Yes.
And Senator Armstrong.
Yep.
Senator Andrews.
Yes.
Senator Heckerman.
Yes.
Senator Klein.
Aye.
Senator Triplett.
Aye.
Motion carries, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, John. Anything else that you have for the committee?
That's it.
Mr.
Chairman.
Senator Andrews.
I was curious. I've been on this committee a long time, but they do have the option of deciding this rule is very important, don't they?
Well, we will send a communication to ESPB informing them that that language is carried over for the next meeting. It would be then up to ESPB to come back and say, no, we insist that that language be included. Then it would be up to the committee to say yes or no on that. Or ESPB may come back and suggest we could change the language thusly. The committee could agree and an amendment could be made. Or they could come back and say, nope, we don't need that language. It's okay. So those are the options.
The only thing I have to say, Mr. Chairman, is we can't quit now because in 15 years we've never finished an administrative rules meeting before noon.
Well, I can vouch for that.
Senator Andrews, I guarantee you will be here by yourself if we're sitting here at noon. I appreciate the effort that went into this committee. I know several of you had conflicts later this morning, and I think we did an excellent job as normal going through the rules. You were well prepared to be here. I had some notes similar to what Representative Coppedon said about our staff counsel, John. I just can't even imagine sitting in this chair as chairman or sitting in a member of the committee without you there to keep us out of hot water, so to speak, but to provide us the legal expertise that you have, John, it was so very much greatly appreciated. I thank you very much. The December meeting, we will get you out something as soon as we can. I know that a lot of people like to make holiday plans and so on. I believe we tried one time to have a meeting during the pre-session or whatever, and it just doesn't work good. And I would guess that being the pre-session is the first week in December, I would guess that it's going to be early in the second week. Is Monday, Monday's a problem for people still if we want to have a Monday? Some people don't like to come in on Sunday, so we could have it, you know, that Tuesday or whatever, but we'll talk about those dates with council. I thank you very much for being here, and we will see you again. Adjourned.
Anything about December?
Okay.
We'll probably have a short agenda. There's not a lot of rules will be coming, so.
I don't mind having it on Monday, but I know in the past some people don't like it on Sunday. Maybe
I like Monday.
Maybe if we have it again. Most of the people drive in Monday morning.
I would assume not if y'all turned around.
Well, we like these days.
Sorry too, just that she couldn't.
I'll go see if my computer's ready and everything. Yeah, I know you're getting ready for tomorrow. Yeah, so I'm gonna leave you alone with that man.
Because people had conflicts.
I guess the rest of the day I had planned on being here, and I have now.
If you were planning on being here the rest of the day, you were the only one in this room that was planning on being here this afternoon.
Well, you know, I had it blocked off on my thing, so as a result, I didn't fill up with meetings and stuff.
No, I don't have to stick around. I got a meeting in Finley I might actually make.